people, says Julio. Well, you can do it through me, Alfredo says. That's one good part. What's that? That's not good. No one can even see you. He won't even have your phone number, Alfredo says. He won't even know who it is that gave it to me or anything. I can probably get him up to 500. Julio mulls this over and then says finally, if he comes up here, then I'll think about it. I can make him go up there. Today, though? Probably. I can have him drive me up, Julio says. Oh, he's got a car? He has access to one. Hold on. Julio switches back to the other line, where his friend has been waiting patiently for news of the negotiations. Julio's way ahead of Alfredo on this one. He knows nobody is seriously planning to drive up to the Bronx to make the deal. To his friend, Julio says, you want to go down there? For what? To get the dough. Serious? His friend asks. Yeah, hold on. Let me make sure he's got it today waiting for me. Hold on, Julio says. Back to Alfredo. Could he have it there waiting for me today? Julio asks. What, the money? No, a firm handshake, Alfredo. What do you think? I guess he could, Alfredo says. I'll call. Hold on. Let me call him up, Alfredo says. Let me go get his number. Wait up. All right. I'll be back in a second, Julio says. Alfredo is consigned to hold again. Julio goes back to his friend, to whom he confides. He thinks so. He's calling the guy up right now. Oh, my God. That guy is for real. I've known him through someone else, as being like a big spender and everything, you know? Like Alfredo is full of bullshit. He says 500. Expect 300, you know? Julio says. Yeah. Like he's just full of moronic bull. But the other guy I know is for real, Julio says. I've got to score big. If I tell you why, you'll laugh at me and say, you're a moron, Julio. What? No, says Julio. It's too much to share his secret. What, like bootleg alcohol? Yeah, come on. You know I'm not into that kind of stuff, Julio says. So what? I want to buy a sky car. Yeah. There, he said it. Oh, my God. Shut up, okay? It was on TV. Did you watch TV last night? Julio asks. Yeah. You saw the Bundys, right? Yeah. While you were wasting your time watching the Bundys, I was watching Beyond Tomorrow. And they got this fresh... No, I'm not even going to explain it to you, because you're going to make light of it, Julio says. Julio, I've seen it before. It's fresh, right? Yo, I'll give my life for that. These conversations, of course, were being recorded by the Secret Service in the Command Center suite at the World Trade Center and meticulously transcribed. This call, in fact, was known as call number Red 3662-3697. Isn't eavesdropping the most amazing thing? You can see why people do it. Julio switches back to Alfredo, who hasn't yet reached Morty. Julio proposes that he and his friend come down to wait for Morty at Alfredo's. But Alfredo says that's not such a good idea. His grandmother was coming over today. We can hang out outside at McDonald's, and then, like, walk into your house once in a while, Julio says. So the deal is struck. They'll meet at Alfredo's apartment, and then go over to the McDonald's on Columbus Avenue, the one on 91st Street, a couple of blocks away. Alfredo tells Julio that if this deal works out, Morty might become a steady customer. He tells Julio that if he can provide a steady supply of Information America accounts, Julio will earn up to $500 a week. That's a lot of money. Julio could use a lot of money. $500 a week is enough to buy a lot of pairs of shoes. That was enough money to share. After Julio disengages both his phone lines, he gets another call from John. Yo, meet me at Alfredo's house in like 2 hours, okay? Julio says. Why? Because me and my buddy were going down there. We're going to meet this guy Morty. And we're going to take Alfredo out of the fucking loop. He's not going to be part of it. What do you mean? John asks. Because Alfredo is already getting too close with Morty. And Morty gave him, like, a dial last night. For, like, a TRW account, Julio says. Get out of here. Morty runs, like, a PI thing.
Oh, yeah?
And he's going to buy, Julio says. Just meet me down there in, like, 2 hours, okay? I need money for tonight's party. Julio says that John should bypass Alfredo's house and go directly to the second floor of McDonald's.
Why?
Because I'm going to sort of accidentally run into you, and then you'll be part of it. Julio says. Now John's part of the deal. Hey, that was cool. One thing about John and Julio, they both had this impression of this Morty guy. They both thought he was rich. He had to be rich. he has access to a car. Did he definitely give Alfredo $1,000 or something? John asks. Yeah, he gave him money, yeah. But $1,000? I think so. But you don't know, John says. Even if we don't get that, you know, who cares, says Julio. I know. I'd do it for 20, Julio says. I know, right? Like I would take 100, John says. Because that's like a pair of sneakers and shit. There's something incongruous about a McDonald's in Manhattan. You don't expect to see the Golden Arches right there, amid all the honking taxicabs and roaring fire trucks and panhandlers. But there was this big neon sign on the outside of the building, touting the McDonald's space station inside, which makes the place seem even sillier than usual. McDonald's in Manhattan always smells greasier than McDonald's in the suburbs. Maybe that was because you can't throw open any windows to let out any of that refried air. Today, all the action was taking place on the second floor of the two-story fast food restaurant. Morty buys the burgers. John acts as the lookout while everybody eats. Yeah, Alfredo was there too. The sun was already starting to go down, and it was cold. It was the kind of weather that makes you want to fill your stomach with a burger. Julio has arrived at McDonald's with valid account information that he plans to sell Morty. But before they do the deal, John pulls him aside and talks Julio out of it. Give him dead stuff, John says, meaning accounts that are no longer good. That'll get Morty off your back, John says. Julio isn't so sure. He really wants the money. Of course, Morty doesn't hear any of this byplay. Morty has these dark, tight ringlets all over his head, hair so curly you can't tell how long it really is, and he keeps looking around, kind of nervous, just looking. So then Julio and John give Morty some accounts that they say he can use to pull credit histories. They tell him it's the good stuff. Morty gives them some money, just pulls it out of his pocket in a big fat wad, and peels off a bunch of $50 bills. $50 bills. He gives Julio 10 of them, and John gets 4. John decides the deal isn't such a bad idea after all. Several hundred bucks for outdated accounts? Sure sounded like a good deal. The meeting lasts about half an hour. The MOD boys walk outside and leave Morty in front of McDonald's. They head down to the neighborhood pizzeria, Alfredo trailing. They have a lot to talk about. Morty walks off in the other direction. It will be interesting to see if these accounts work, he thinks. Of course, maybe Morty wouldn't be losing anything if they don't work. John would later say the 50s were counterfeit. In fact, Morty complained to Alfredo that the accounts didn't work. After a number of phone calls, disclaimers, recriminations, and posturing, Julio finally gave Morty a valid TRW account. Morty proceeded to use the account, diving into the credit union database as if he were on some kind of supermarket shopping spree. In less than a week, Morty had pulled 175 credit reports. One night, around 10 o'clock, Mark and Julio are on the phone, just talking about the things friends talk about. Julio's not thinking about the deal he did with Morty. He's not thinking about the possible repercussions. He's thinking about something much more existential. Like, what would you do if you found out you had cancer? I'd tell it. The whole world. Everything, Mark says. If I knew I was going to die in a year, I would still keep it to myself for like 8 months, you know? Until you were, like, on your deathbed or something, Mark says. Yeah. Then you'd, like, make appearances on national TV and tell the world? No, I would rather, like, give it to a couple of people, Julio says. Why? You think you'd only give it to a couple of friends? Mark asks. If I was going to die, I'd want to piss off the phone company as much as I could. So I'd, like, tell the whole world everything. No, you know what I would probably do?
What?
Mark asks. Instead of telling everyone, I would crash everything.
Nah, the crashing everything isn't fun, Mark says.
Because they would always say, oh, it was equipment failure, before they'd admit that a hacker did it. Say I'm dying, says Julio. Or do it while you're on TV, Mark says. That's even better.
Yeah, like Channel 4, right?
It's like, here, I'm going to knock out phone service in Texas. Click. And then you go, like, demonstrate. You go and call Texas, Mark says. And it's like, why would you do something like this? Oh, I'll be dead in a couple of weeks. Like, say I'm taking out 911 in the South Bronx, Julio says.
Yeah, right.
And then imagine, like a doctor runs in. I was wrong. Those were your dog's x-rays, Julio says. And, like, you're perfectly okay. And then you're like, oops.
I know. And then you have a heart attack and die.
No. You don't have a heart attack. You get arrested, Julio says. And, like, why'd you do it?
No. But then you have a stroke on the way to jail, Mark says. I would probably kill myself if I knew I was going to get in that much trouble, Julio says.
15. Julio could only remember seeing his father cry twice, just twice, in his whole life. Once on the day of Julio's grandfather's funeral, and a second time on December 6th, 1991. That was the day the Secret Service raided Julio's apartment, carting off every bit of computer equipment in the place, even confiscating the dark-colored backpack Julio carried to school every day. For months, Julio had been feeling confident, thinking himself immune to the process of justice, as he called it. He'd seen plenty of hackers get raided, and nothing bad had ever happened to them. Why should he worry? Mark never went to jail. Eli never went to jail. Paul never went to jail. In fact, in the nearly 2 years that had passed since the first federal raids of the MOD case, Eli and Paul had never even been charged with any crimes. To Julio, those first raids seemed silly, almost mythical. The 1990 raids his friends had endured seemed like, well, like a badge of honor more than anything else. But then, the Secret Service agents showed up at Julio's house at 11 a.m., and they carted out his Apple IIc, his monitor, his modem, his manuals, and documents. His records and notebooks, his floppies, his cassette tapes. Just like that, it was gone. All gone. Julio was not home at the time. His brother Louis was there, though, and he told the agents that Julio was on his way to school. More agents out on the street were already following Julio. They had followed him down from the Bronx to Manhattan, where they were watching him make a phone call from a payphone at 42nd and Park. Later, they took his backpack and all the cassette tapes and the floppy disk inside it. And when Julio got home, he realized this was not a joke. Not at all. His dad was crying. And there went Julio's bravado. Of course, Julio was not the only one who got raided on this cold December day. Alan Wilson's two-story single-family home on Moon Drive in Fallingston, Pennsylvania, was also included. In the search warrant application, the Secret Service told the judge that the MOD boys had said during a phone conversation that Alan had stolen two laptop computers. The Secret Service also told the judge that Alan had told John of stealing electronic mail messages meant for Chris Goggins. A photo of a federal agent in Alan's house would show up in Alan's local paper soon after the raid. John got raided, too. He lost his Zenith Compact TV, as well as his computer. Alfredo got raided, but you might have expected that. He'd been running his own call cell operation, selling people long-distance service over some unwitting corporate switchboard. And Morty Rosenfeld got raided. Mark got raided, the only member of MOD to earn a second visit. He sat on the couch in his living room, listening to an agent read his Miranda rights. You have the right to remain silent. The little speech was printed on a business card. The agent flipped it, and Mark saw 9X written on the front. The agent asked Mark to initial the card to acknowledge the exchange. The federal agents took boxes and boxes of computer equipment. Really, sometimes it seemed more like a job for a moving company than a crack law enforcement agency. And then, for a few months, history repeated itself. Nobody heard another word from the government. Stephen Fishbein sat in his office high over Lower Manhattan, trying to create a criminal case from a morass. He had too much information and no sense of a pattern. He knows John and Julio have sold access codes to Morty. That's obviously illegal. But beyond that isolated incident, Fishbein had millions of bytes of data from data tap sessions, pages and pages of transcribed notes from nearly 5,000 phone conversations, toll records, DNRs, and now boxes and boxes full of floppy disks, hard drives, and notebooks seized in the raids. He knows the case is bigger than just John and Julio and TRW and Southwestern Bell, but he has no idea how things fit together, where to start. He reads, and one day he comes across a single document that sets a new direction for the case, the history of MOD. The history of MOD told the story of how five boys knew each other, the scope of their relationship. It was a starting point. There was an organized group involved. They even had a name for themselves, MOD, and they dated back to 1989. And here was John and Julio coming into the gang as corrupt and outlaw. And, wait a minute, they were talking about how they got raided by the Secret Service once before? The history of MOD, the tale that Eli had concocted so innocuously, had become the blueprint Fishbein used to understand who all these boys were, how they all worked together as a group. Hey, the guys from the old case were totally in with the new guys. In fact, the old guys were giving instructions to the new guys. The document even hinted at murky fringe benefits the boys got from hacking. It said each person in the group has his own illegal specialty.
Before anybody knew what was going on, Fishbein and Harris were riding out to the Eastern District to talk to the prosecutors there. Now Fishbein heard the whole story. He knows Mark is a repeat offender. He knows this conspiracy dates back several years. He learns that the Eastern District even sent off all the evidence seized in the 1990 raids to Belcour, where the earlier crop of floppies and hard drives and notebooks had been scrupulously analyzed. Page after page of Mark's notebooks, crammed full of phone numbers, commands, usernames, and doodles of a surfer catching a wave in the margin, all had been analyzed. Belcour's work was so thorough that the prosecutors could use the notes to say, with authority, that a certain phone number he wrote on page 3 is to a switch. A user ID on page 11 was a valid login you could use to get into a switch. This command here on page 67 functioned on the switch. Page after page of hieroglyphics decoded. As for the doodling, well, the surfer seemed to be just a surfer. Fishbein decided the best thing to do was to separate the cases of Morty and Alfredo from the case of the MOD boys. That seemed to be a natural division. The involvement of Morty and Alfredo was on the fringe of what really happened. It would be easier to get indictments and wouldn't confuse the jurors. Sure enough, Morty was indicted. Alfredo was indicted. What was next? In the spring of 1992, a grand jury began to hear evidence that Fishbein had accumulated, sorted, digested, and turned into a story. The history of MOD. The letters arrive in June of 1992. The letters come in long white envelopes and look very stern and official. They are mailed to the MOD members who got raided in 1990 and 1991. Mark, Paul, Eli, John, and Julio all get them. You are the target of a grand jury investigation, each letter says. Paul remembers it as an odd sensation opening his letter, reading it, processing the information the letter seemed to convey. You are the target of a grand jury investigation. Paul hadn't really been part of any MOD group activities for more than 2 years at this point. He dropped out of the scene after the 1990 raids. And yet, here it was, the whole mess from his late adolescence rising up to haunt him as a young man. Was Paul even the same person 2 years later? He was an adult now, an adult being held accountable for a child's actions. Would the grand jury realize that? The grand jury? Just saying the words to himself was terrifying. There was a group of people impaneled, in some court, hearing testimony about him. They were sitting there, all day, in a room, hearing witnesses describe all kinds of illegal things he'd supposedly done. Who were these witnesses? What were they saying? What could they know of Paul? What exactly did he do during those long-ago late-night hacking sessions? He tried to remember. Imagine a room full of strangers all listening intently to the most intimate details of your hacking forays, all trying to comprehend exactly what you did when, all relying on the prosecutor to make this confusing technical jargon understandable. Fewer than one family in three even owned a personal computer. Fewer still had modems. Good luck. Alan's a really helpful guy. Sure he is. Look at him making these annoying trips from Pennsylvania to Manhattan whenever the prosecutor called. Alan's family hired a lawyer to accompany him. The other boys heard that his lawyer had put together a nice deal for Alan, that Alan was cooperating against his friends. The feds were grateful, the other MOD boys hear. Alan's information was helping build a stronger case against them. Most of the boys didn't have the cash to hire their own attorneys. Paul, Mark, Eli, and John will get court-appointed lawyers. Mark got assigned a good lawyer, but he still worried privately, even as he called the charges nonsense. It bothered him more than you could see. He felt it in his stomach, the rat gnawing at his gut. Eli's lawyer complained to Fishbein that Eli was unfairly lumped in with the rest of the boys. After all, Eli hadn't owned a computer for 2 years. Yes, Fishbein says, but he had Eli's voice in late 1991 on the phone asking his friends to provide him with illegal credit information from TRW. Paul got a court-appointed lawyer named Marjorie Pierce, who told him one day that the assistant U.S. attorney in charge of the case wanted to speak with him. That was how Paul and Fishbein met for the first time. They were not likely to hit it off. Paul is shy and sullen, wears his hair halfway down his back, cinched in a ponytail. Fishbein is aggressive and sure of himself, an alumnus of both Yale Law School and a Scarsdale childhood, with neat dark hair and simple round eyeglasses. They are not that far apart in age, born less than 15 years apart, in fact, but they might as well have been from different countries. Fishbein likes opera and ballet, and he retires at night to a studio apartment where he plays classical music on an upright piano positioned in the exact center of an oriental rug. He does not have a computer in his home. Fishbein has told Marjorie Pierce that if Paul wants leniency, he should tell the truth about exactly what he did and when he did it. Fishbein felt some sympathy for these boys, although he could not empathize with their actions. He is not a man who has ever contemplated breaking the law. But most of the other defendants he'd faced as a prosecutor have been more obviously hardened criminals. Men who were selling drugs or involved in drug conspiracies or taking bribes at banks or savings and loans. The crimes of these boys were different. They were committed in the first flush of adolescent bad judgment, not in the cold, avaricious world of drug dealing and sleazy bribery. Fishbein's objective at this stage of the game was to get as much information as possible from any of the MOD boys willing to talk. He wanted to hear Paul's story. So Marjorie Pierce and Paul go down to St. Andrew's Plaza, which houses the U.S. Attorney's Office in Lower Manhattan. The relentlessly modular building is jammed into a too-small spot, hard, by venerable St. Andrew's Church. 200 years ago, St. Andrew's Church must have looked grand. But now it looks like an old barnacle, ready to be scraped away by progress. Paul and his lawyer pass through a metal detector in the lobby, and wear sticky badges that proclaim their visitor status. They go upstairs to Fishbein's offices, and Paul is struck by how businesslike the whole situation is. Secret Service agent Rick Harris is there, too. They all sit around a table in a conference room, and Fishbein isn't trying to intimidate Paul. He just lays out the facts. He tells Paul this is real serious business. Marjorie Pierce has told Paul beforehand that it would be a good idea to express some remorse at this juncture in the meeting. So Paul just lowers his head, trying to look like a pussycat when you yell at it. Then Paul tells Fishbein that he hasn't been involved in MOD's computer intrusions since the 1990 raids. He doesn't admit to Fishbein that he's been secretly logging into New York University's computer system and then dialing out from an account there to make free long-distance phone calls. He doesn't admit that he's been doing the same thing with the Hunter College system in Manhattan, and that will count against him. Someone asks Paul to leave the room. The rest of them stay behind, and a few minutes later, Marjorie Pierce comes out to tell Paul that the prosecutors won't budge. There's no way Paul can escape being indicted. She says that the only way to escape is to testify against his friends. What Paul remembers hearing even years later when he imagines this incident is the suggestion that he rat. Paul thinks Pierce's suggestion over. He's been puzzling over this for a while now, ever since the rumor started about how Alan was cooperating. Paul thinks about how he's in the middle of college, how jail could really screw up his life. Paul thinks about how dumb this whole situation is. No place for the valedictorian of Thomas Edison High School to be. About how his explorations on the Lurleton switch occurred so long ago that it feels like a different lifetime. Then Paul opens his mouth, and he says without explanation, "No way." Paul doesn't tell anybody what he's really thinking, which is this: I'd rather live 6 months being locked up somewhere with some degree of honor than to be dishonorable and walk freely in the streets. Those are Paul's words. Those are Paul's thoughts. But how could you say it out loud without sounding foolish? There's not much left to say, and a few minutes later, Paul and his lawyer leave the building. They ride down in the elevator to the lobby, past the metal detector, out the doors to the plaza strewn with pigeon droppings. The indictment has 11 counts. Each count is punishable by at least 5 years in jail. Each count carries a maximum fine of $250,000. The first count the grand jury charges is conspiracy. The indictment charges that all of the boys conspired to gain access to and control of computer systems in order to enhance their image and prestige among computer hackers, a violation of Title 18 of the U.S. Criminal Code. The other counts charge some of the individual boys with unauthorized access to computers, switches, and TimeNet, possession of unauthorized access devices, long-distance calling card numbers, 4 counts of interception of electronic communications, snatching IDs and passwords from TimeNet files, and 4 counts of wire fraud, stealing the use of New York University's phone lines to make phone calls to El Paso and Seattle. The indictment is full of fancy language that was really saying only one thing. You could go to jail. So could you, and you, and you, and you, for a long time. Paul could get 5 years. Eli could get 5 years. Mark could get 10 years. Julio could get 35 years. John could get 45 years. The case is so big, so sensational, so groundbreaking that the U.S. attorney himself calls a press conference in the lobby of St. Andrew's Plaza. He wants to announce the indictment to the media. It's a little off-putting, the rows of folding chairs hastily arranged with their backs to the metal detector and the bulletproof U.S. Marshal's booth. A stream of New York's finest, the press corps that is, slouches and starts bitching for handouts. The indictment is a 23-page document dense with facts, counts, and legalese.
The press release that explains what the indictment is trying to say is 8 pages long. And then there are charts that Secret Service agent Rick Harris arranges on an easel. This was before Ross Perot, remember, and the charts are a novel idea. Among other things, the charts explain what a switch is. The basic point the prosecution is trying to get across is the national scope of the computer intrusions. This is the crime of the future, says U.S. Attorney Otto Obermeier, a tall, patrician man in a dark suit. He points a finger to underscore his distaste for computer crimes. The message that ought to be delivered from this indictment is that this kind of conduct will not be tolerated. These 5 boys are being charged with the most widespread intrusions of the nation's largest and most sensitive computer systems ever recorded. The government has decided to make an example of these teenagers from the outer boroughs. The message, which is what Obermeier calls it, is zero tolerance. If you're a hacker thinking of following in the footsteps of the masters of deception, think again. There's hardly room behind the podium for all the lawmen trying to get a piece of this one. There are the prosecutors. Then there are agents from the FBI and the Secret Service. And there are men from the U.S. Justice Department's Computer Crime Unit. Obermeier tells the press corps all about the crimes. He tells them the boys' intrusions have cost companies thousands of dollars in security personnel salaries and lost processing time. But he doesn't tell them that the dangerous hackers are, in effect, just a bunch of teenage boys who got to be friends because they shared a hobby. He doesn't mention the long nights in Eli's bedroom, doesn't talk about any of their inside jokes, doesn't say plick once. After Obermeier finishes his speech, the questioning does not go the way you'd expect. The indictment says they sold TRW credit reports. So how much did they get? Asks a reporter in the front row. Several hundred dollars. Obermeier declines to be more specific. Where did the damages come in? Someone asks. Fishbein explains that the phone companies in TimeNet had to spend a lot of money to fix security holes. Isn't that like charging a burglar for the bars you buy to put up on your windows? Someone else asks. It's fair game, Fishbein says, because of the huge number of billable hours the victims' companies burned patching up after the kids were through there. The reporter from the New York Post shrugs. His newspaper is a tabloid, the feistiest in town, and he came here in the misguided hope that this would be a hot story. He's been at this job for a long time. He's covered organized crime, and organized crime doesn't look like this. He's covered conspiracies, and they don't act like this. These are just kids. There are no bodies. There's no sex. And the crime, if there is one, will be very hard to explain in the small amount of space he'll get. After the reporters file out, the room is pretty empty. It's just a dingy lobby again. Except for one thing. In the back, way behind the last row of folding chairs, stands Mark. He's the defendant, and here he is listening to the prosecutors announce his capture. Rarely does the accused appear at the prosecutor's media briefing. But here he is, the ringleader. A cameraman from one of the TV stations hugs him on the way out. The story makes NBC's national newscast at 6:30 with Tom Brokaw. It's the piece Brokaw ends with. A forward tilt, something to think about piece. There's a headshot of Fishbein speaking to the press, and a close-up of Mark teaching a computer class at the new School for Social Research in Greenwich Village. Another shot focuses on Paul, sitting in the first row in the classroom and identified in a voiceover as the Scorpion. The piece closes with Mark talking to the NBC reporter on a dark and rainy street. Mark says that he's definitely the victim of political persecution. 16. There will never be a trial. So a lot of the arguments that might have been made about whether what the boys did with their computers was truly wrong would never be aired. A lot of murky issues would never be tested. For instance, was it really against the law to possess on a floppy disk you carry around at school the phrase, "Five Star Sucks"? There would never be a jury to decide whether publicizing the credit history of your rival's mom was crime enough to go to prison for a year, or whether crashing the learning link and calling its operators "you turkeys" was crime enough to earn a jail sentence. If there had been a trial, well, then the MOD conspiracy case could have set a precedent for the entire country, could have established a benchmark by which the government could track down other so-called computer criminals. But there wouldn't be a trial, because all the MOD boys had pled guilty over the course of the year. They all had given up. What was left after that? It was up to the prosecutors to recommend a certain sentence, and up to the judge to mete it out. That's how justice works. From the day of Otto Obermeier's press conference, the case looks unbeatable to the defense lawyers. The government sends them copies of the evidence, pages and pages of wiretap conversations in which John and Julio discuss the intricacies, passwords, and logins of proprietary corporate systems. Sometimes Mark was on the wiretaps,
explaining precisely how to defeat TimeNet's security. A few times, Eli was recorded too, asking Julio to use TRWNet to look up confidential credit reports. Federal law says it's illegal to break into private computer systems, and here the government had thousands of pages of notes written in the boys' own hands that incriminate them. Passwords and logins for phone company computers, long-distance access codes, and in case the defense attorneys want to argue that simple possession of this information was no crime, well, then the government had hundreds of pages of printouts from dial number recorders that show precisely which New York telephone computers were dialed from the boys' homes. And you want to talk about intent? Do you want to make the argument that these were just poor scientists and the world was their laboratory? Then try explaining Julio and John taking money from Morty. Try explaining that phone call where Julio said to Mark, "I would, like, crash everything." The facts trouble Mitch Kapor and John Perry Barlow, whose Electronic Frontier Foundation has been monitoring the progression of the MOD boys' case since the very beginning. They wonder whether the government has taken to picking on defenseless teenagers. One day in 1992, the EFF's staff lawyer, yes, there's a staff now, and an office in Cambridge, comes to New York City to investigate. The EFF lawyer is named Mike Godwin. He looks over all the government's evidence against Mark, and he consults with Mark's lawyer, Larry Schoenbach. Godwin tells Mitch that the foundation should become more involved in this case, and that if Mark gets up on the witness stand, he might be able to convince a jury that what the boys did wasn't enough to land anybody in jail. Godwin, who once was the editor of a daily newspaper at the University of Texas in Austin, has friends among the reporters at Newsweek and other national publications. He lays out a sweeping media campaign that EFF could wage. But Godwin's boss, Mitch, isn't so sure. For one thing, he doesn't like the idea that Mark kept hacking, even after his first bust. Then there's another, bigger reason that the MOD case looks unappealing. The political world was changing as fast as the online world was in the last half of 1992. Bill Clinton might be headed for the White House, and his would-be vice president, Al Gore, has promised to do everything he can to build what Gore has dubbed a national information superhighway. The White House will have a lot to say about government's role in policing the new electronic frontier, and the EFF want to be in a position to influence the administration's gurus. People have warned Mitch that at this critical juncture in the young organization's development, the EFF should avoid being labeled a hacker defense fund. You didn't get anybody's ear in the Capitol with a moniker like that. The EFF's board of directors finally voted to move the organization's headquarters from Boston down to Washington, D.C. If you were an adult and watching closely, you'd see the message in this. There was more important work to be done than fighting a losing battle on behalf of a bunch of New York City kids who should have known better. But what the EFF conveyed to Mark is this: do what you think you have to, and we'll help if we can. Mark doesn't know what to do. One day in November, he meets Schoenbach at his office on the east side of Manhattan. For once, Mark arrives early. He wears baggy jeans and a pristine white turtleneck, an outfit complemented by a gold hoop in his left ear and his signature bandana, which fits neatly over the ring of hair he recently shaved close. He and his lawyer go to lunch at City Luck, a Chinese restaurant around the corner. Mark orders skewered steak, steak on a stick, he calls it, a Coke, and egg drop soup. He does not braid the chopsticks. Schoenbach and Mark discuss the upcoming meeting with the prosecutors to take place 3 days from now. Mark's allergies bother him, as usual. He sniffs and sneezes and blows his nose as Schoenbach explains that Fishbein is about to offer a deal to all the MOD defendants. Schoenbach figures that in a case like this, if the defendant pleads guilty and obviate the need for a lengthy and costly trial, then the prosecutors could recommend lenient sentences, maybe even no jail time. The MOD boys could all go on with their lives. The downside is that all the boys would be convicted felons. They can't hold office or vote for the rest of their lives. It's a rough choice for Mark, especially since he doesn't believe he did anything wrong. Schoenbach advises Mark to take the plea. Now, this advice is worth as much as any lawyer's in this country. Schoenbach has years of experience navigating the federal court system, representing high-profile clients accused of crimes so heinous they don't bear repeating. Terrorists accused of bombing U.S. targets, alleged mafia functionaries, accused murderers. Although Larry has a fancy East Side office, the Trondoyer bookshelves in his lobby make this place as chic as any space in Manhattan. He also defends a lot of very poor clients. He's on the federal court system's roster of court-appointed attorneys. Unlike the public defenders who work in state court, these federal defense attorneys are actually guaranteed a decent hourly fee, courtesy of the U.S. court system. It's not bad money, so the job attracts quite a few private practice attorneys who wouldn't normally be attainable.
And that's how clients like alleged terrorists and suspected members of Chinese extortion gangs get an attorney like Schoenbach. Mark is Schoenbach's first client accused of computer conspiracy. And at first, Schoenbach may have been a little befuddled by all this talk of TimeNet access, kilobytes, and hacker meetings to plan the conspiracy. But back in August, Schoenbach went to see the hackers gather for their 2600 conflagration. And what he saw of the hackers' culture, essentially a bunch of wispy mustached boys cavorting awkwardly and shyly in the indoor plaza, convinced him that if you cut through all the technical crap, the case was pretty simple. A bunch of teenagers were trespassing. They got caught. And for this, the government wants to label them felons. Schoenbach doesn't think it's right, but he knows the law. And the law says that what Mark and his friends are accused of doing is illegal. That's the law. And unless you want to argue that the law is wrong, you don't have much of a defense. He tells all this to Mark, but Mark is trying to navigate an unfamiliar and terrifying terrain. He can't pull back far enough to see the contour of the landscape. He reminds Schoenbach that nothing really happened the last time he pleaded guilty. Just community service. He hears, but doesn't hear, Schoenbach's warnings that the judge could be harder on a second-time offender. He hears but doesn't hear his friend's imprecations to stand united. He plays with his food in the restaurant. He orders a second Coke. Mike Godwin calls Mark on the phone one night. He tells him that he knows that Schoenbach thinks Mark should plead guilty. He tells Mark that he will stand by him no matter what decision he makes. At the meeting with Fishbein, the defense attorneys ask whether the prosecutor would recommend a lenient sentence, maybe no jail time at all, if all five boys agree to plead together. Wrap up the whole case at once, you know? Easier for the prosecution. Fishbein checked with his bosses and said, well, okay. But in the meantime, Mark has changed his mind. He refuses to plead. His friends try to convince him otherwise, but he will have none of it. By this time, all the boys know where they stand. Each has made a trip, accompanied by an attorney, to Fishbein's office. Fishbein has laid out the evidence. Here's what we have on you. The boys sat stony and implacable, taking it in, thinking this. I'm going to jail. Oh, shit, I am really going to jail. The facts are glaring to John and Julio. They're charged with the most counts. They're facing the most prison time. After all, John and Julio actually sold TRW accounts to Morty Rosenfeld. The government could argue pretty convincingly that John and Julio were hacking for profit. They wanted to make money off their crimes. It doesn't look good. John and Julio are likely to get stiffer sentences than the other boys if this case goes to trial and they lose. Both boys talk with their lawyers about the situation. They will plead guilty on December 2nd. They arrive at the federal courthouse, a broad wedding cake of a building, looking nervous. John wears a giant sweatshirt, but carries a white dress shirt still protected by a plastic dry cleaner's bag. Julio wears a suit. As part of his guilty plea, John submits a written statement. I was part of a group called MOD. The members of the group exchanged information, including passwords, so that we could gain access to computer systems which we were not authorized to access. I got passwords by monitoring TimeNet, calling phone company employees and pretending to be computer technicians, using computer programs designed to steal passwords. It's not exactly in John's own words, but he and his attorney have written it out, and now it's Court Exhibit 3 in the government's case against him. I acknowledge that I and others plan to share passwords and transmitted information across state boundaries by modem or telephone lines, and by doing so, obtain the monetary value of the use of the systems I would otherwise have had to pay for. What? In other words, he made some free calls. Who knows how much those calls were worth? The government can't even say. I apologize for my actions and am very sorry for the trouble I have caused to all concerned, the statement concludes. The judge accepts John's plea. Then Julio stands up and admits that he broke the law. There was a phone call I received on November 5th. John called me up and gave me passwords. That's all there is to it. They will be sentenced another day. John and Julio leave the courtroom, walking past a vendor selling umbrellas. The vendor yells to them, "Snow's coming. Get your umbrella. Snow tonight, tomorrow, and the next day." From that day on, the masters of deception no longer existed. Word leaked out that Julio had agreed to cooperate with the government, to testify against Mark at his trial. Julio was angry that Mark had refused a deal. Fishbein won't confirm that Julio was cooperating, but the hackers all saw through that. Paul no longer spoke to Julio. Mark no longer spoke to Julio, and refers to him as Julio the Rat. Eli tried to make peace between the former friends, but it was too late. The five boys weren't standing together anymore. They were on their own. Mark didn't talk much more about his decision to go to trial. He says he's innocent, of course. What did he steal? What did he break? The EFF will help him, of course. He'd pull a miracle on 34th Street defense. Yes, I did all that stuff. But where was the harm? All it took was one juror to understand that, and there would never be a conviction. Still, the pending trial upset Mark's stomach. The tension was making him physically ill. The U.S. Attorney's Office has to prepare a full-blown trial, prepare dozens of witnesses to testify, organize rooms and rooms of evidence into a coherent argument that will convince a jury. A second assistant U.S. attorney, Jeffrey Berman, gets assigned to the case with Fishbein. Together, Berman and Fishbein start to marshal their resources. Fred Staples spends hours and hours downtown, helping to decipher the lines of numbers and times and dates that the DNRs have generated. It's not as easy as it might seem, because if a hacker first dialed an ITT dial-up, then used an ITT PIN number to place a call, then dialed a 10-digit long-distance number, all those figures would run together in a long stream, just as they were originally dialed. So Fred helps sort it out. Fishbein and Berman make a list of potential witnesses. They interview staff at the Learning Link. They interview the system administrator of Southwestern Bell's C-Scans computers. They talk to officials from all the other phone companies and businesses who were victimized. They prepare elaborate charts and graphics for the jury to explain the context of high-tech computer crimes. The other hackers hear that Berman has even tracked down Pumpkin Pete and convinced him to testify. The first skirmish is a pretrial hearing that stretches over a two-day period in March of 1993. The purpose of the hearing is to get a ruling from the judge about the admissibility of certain portions of evidence that the government has gathered. Lawyers for the three remaining defendants try to convince the judge, Richard Owen, to throw out much of the evidence that the government has gathered. The defense attorneys argue that the information from the DNRs was obtained illegally. They argue that as far back as the summer of 1989, the phone company was acting as a de facto agent of the government, gathering information and funneling it straight to the Secret Service. Because the phone company has been working with the Secret Service, the DNR should not have been placed on the boys' phones without a court order, they argue. But then Fishbein stands up to refute the argument. The statute says that DNRs can be installed to find out about computer intrusions of their systems. New York Telephone is the victim. The New York Telephone investigation began well before the Secret Service investigation, and it was done purely to detect fraud and abuse of the system. Judge Owen sides with the prosecution. He appears to be exasperated by the defendants. Owen likens the phone company to a private citizen who has been robbed of property. If a private citizen believes that his stolen property is in an apartment, and he busts in and gets it, and turns it over to the government, then his actions aren't at the behest of the government, Owen says. Owen's ruling is a blow to the defense, because it means that every bit of information from the DNRs, that damning stream of numbers, now all typed out in neat chart form, can be introduced to a jury. Attorneys for the defendants also argue a second point, that statements made by Eli and Paul to Secret Service agents should be suppressed because they were obtained illegally. Paul testifies that he was intimidated by agents who searched his dorm room in 1990, and days later he was coerced into giving a statement about his hacking activities. Owens is skeptical. You're not shy, the judge tells Paul, who, truth be told, was blushing mightily at the moment. You've got a title of Scorpion. There's a little fellow with a big stinger in his tail who gave you that. Over the years, Owen has developed a reputation as a tough-talking pro-prosecution judge. He's easily irritated by defense attorneys' assertions that the authorities violate the civil rights of virtually every defendant who stands in his courtroom. Owens has handled too many high-profile cases to list them all, but a couple of years before the MOD boys set foot in his courtroom, Owen sentenced mobsters Tony Ducks Corallo, Tony Salerno, and Carmine Persico to 100 years each of jail time. He had also presided over the enormously complicated racketeering and fraud trial of a lawyer accused of taking payoffs from the notorious Bronx defense contractor, WedTech. The boys standing before Owen's bench are more of the same, defendants accused of breaking federal law. Soon after Owen ruled against the defendants' efforts to limit evidence against them, Paul and Eli decided to plead guilty. It's pretty clear, the way things are going, that this is the only choice, Paul says. At his sentencing, Paul stands before the judge, wearing a suit. A rubber band holds his blonde hair in a ponytail that hangs halfway to his waist. I realize I broke the law. I didn't do it to make money or hurt anyone, he says, apologizing. A lot of it was for intelligent curiosity, to see how computers were operating. Paul asks for leniency. I ask your honor to give me a chance to prove I can offer something to society. The judge looks sternly at him. One problem I have with all the young people in this case is you're all so bright. That's really what distresses the deuce out of me. Paul and Eli each get a sentence of 6 months in a federal penitentiary,
followed by 6 months home detention. Owen sentences John, too. On a somber rainy day in the summer of 1993, with his mother, stoic, sitting in a hard wooden bench behind him, John stands in a charcoal gray suit before Owen. He says, "I'm really sorry for the things I've done." John says that he's grown up a lot in the past year and a half since the raids. He's been having a lot of fun, actually, working as a stand-up comedian in local clubs. He's also in college now, a film major at Brooklyn College. Filmmaking has become his new obsession. He's been making films on the subways, and everyone loves them. The films are funny, and they make people laugh. In fact, some of his professors have written to the judge asking for leniency because John shows such promise. "I want to do a film project," John tells the judge. He wants to do an anti-hacking public service type announcement, put his various talents to good use. The judge is impassive. John clears his throat and continues. "I've always tried to please my mother, and I've let her down. I guess I'm rambling. My mother stood behind me. I've accepted completely that I would have to face jail time for what I've done." Owen listens, then sits silent for some minutes. Then he says, "He went to the finest honors high school this city has to offer. He was in the swim with some of the brightest men and women. A kid with computer gifts can get out of Stuyvesant and go to any college he wants to. He had before him the opportunity to go absolutely to the limit." The judge looks at John. "You have the world practically given to you." Who in the courtroom besides John and his mother, Lorraine, chokes on that weird statement? Owen takes the world away. John won't be back to college in the fall because the judge sentences him to a year in jail, followed by 3 years of supervised release and 200 hours of community service. Oh, yes, and a fine of $50. Then Owen looks over at John's lawyer and asks, "When does your client want to surrender?" So now Mark was the last holdout. Meanwhile, Julio's sentencing was delayed. Everyone figured that was because Julio had agreed to testify against Mark at trial and would subsequently be rewarded with a suspended sentence. Julio was making regular trips to the U.S. Attorney's Office, meeting with Fishbein and Berman, helping them build a case against Mark. Over and over again, Julio reviewed the evidence and the questions he'd be asked on the stand during Mark's trial. He would be the government's star witness. "Mark taught me everything I know." Mark started to prepare for trial. During long meetings with Larry Schoenbach and Schoenbach's partner, he is becoming intimately familiar with the mountain of evidence against him. He is coming to believe that his chances of an acquittal are next to nothing. And yet Mark believed he had taken a position that he couldn't back away from. The EFF was no longer actively involved in his case. A chastened Godwin briefly lost his job, partly because he pushed his bosses for a commitment to the case. Godwin backed off after he was reinstated as staff counsel. Barlow felt bad about the whole thing. He believed that the mixed signals the EFF had sent had turned the MOD case into a bloody casualty of the EFF's struggle to define itself as an organization. He viewed the foundation and its founders as deeply divided. He himself has never known whether he wanted to be a Republican or an outlaw, and he wondered if Mitch would rather be a guru or a CEO. Barlow thought that by backing away from the case, the EFF might be betraying its own roots. But by now, events were beginning to overtake everyone. Mark's lackluster participation had soured Larry Schoenbach as well. Mark was late to meetings. Mark skipped meetings. Mark was taciturn and sullen. If this is how he behaved when dealing with his lawyer, how would he look to a jury when he took the stand in his own defense? The trial was scheduled to begin July 5th. During the last week in June, Fishbein and Berman put the finishing touches to their case. Berman rehearsed his opening statement to the jury. Then, on Thursday, 5 days before the start of trial, Mark's lawyer called Fishbein and said, "We really should talk about a plea." The next morning, Friday, Mark stood in court and echoed the words of his friends. "I plead guilty, Your Honor." Why plead guilty now? Schoenbach said it made no sense. Had Mark gone to trial and lost, it was unlikely that he would have earned more time in jail than he did by taking a plea so late in the game. But Mark has told people that by pleading on the eve of trial, he got something none of the other defendants did, a complete understanding of what his defense would have been. He saw every last plank of support laid out. And in the end, what he'd seen scared him. After. The hackers who arrive at the city court building on the first Friday of February wear heavy hiking boots, thick-soled turf crunchers, and kicked around black leather shoes that lace up, up, up their calves. Of course, if it were July, they wouldn't be dressed any differently. This is the uniform. It is 1994 now, and tonight's meeting is the first gathering in nearly 5 years at which no one from MOD is present. Dozens of hackers are here, ranging in age from 14 to 40, far more muffle-jacketed attendees than in the days of early 1989. The world has changed since that heady time when Mark and Paul and Eli and John and Julio all somehow found each other, all somehow coalesced. In fact, it's as if the rest of the world has caught up. What the MOD boys did for fun, recreationally cruising across continents of wires, has become a national pastime. Net surfing is a bigger fad than CB radio ever was, and people everywhere are buying their first computers and hooking up to online services that connect them to the world and to one another. My mom, your mom, everybody's entranced. So it's no wonder that the new numbers of an eager generation are filling the Citicorp atrium. Tonight there's a hole where Mark used to be, a spot by the payphones where he'd like to stand patiently while a group of respectful protégés would gather to ask him highly technical questions. Tonight you will not see his familiar blue and white bandana. You will not hear the boom and heave of his voice. You will not wonder how many bowls of homemade chicken soup he will consume later downtown. Tonight, Mark is far away. Mark has arrived at the gates of Pennsylvania's Schuylkill Prison late one night in January, right after a snowstorm, and was whisked inside before his friends could say goodbye. He started serving a year-long sentence, the longest stint in jail that any of the MOD boys would serve. The sentencing judge said that Mark, by his actions, chose to be a messenger for the hacking community, and so the judge said he had no recourse but to send a message back. Hundreds of people had sent letters to the judge, urging him to be lenient. The letters came from an electronic community that had flourished with Mark's help. The community is called ECHO, which stands for East Coast Hangout. ECHO was a local New York City bulletin board before Mark was hired as a system administrator, a job he took while waiting to be sentenced. Mark quickly connected ECHO to the Internet, the worldwide collection of more than 15,000 interconnected computer networks. The world of the Internet, for newcomers, is a fabulously confusing place. In other words, a perfect place for Mark Abeen to demystify. And the members of ECHO, lawyers, doctors, schoolteachers, writers, came to rely on Mark as their instructor and travel guide. He found, as lucky adults often do, creative work that consumed him and that paid him a wage. His job will be waiting when he gets out of jail. On the day Mark drove off to prison, many of his friends on ECHO add the name Optic to their online names. Someone printed up buttons that say Free Fiber Optic, and the Village Voice ran a feature calling Mark the first martyr of the information age. A kind of vigil is set up every day online while he's in jail. A list is set up on ECHO of things Mark needs, and people sent him magazines and books and hundreds of letters. On ECHO, he had also found a girlfriend. She misses him desperately, and every day posts a message on ECHO, updating his new friends on his condition and mood in jail. She says she just wants her fiber back home, sitting in the bathtub with her and catching milk duds she tosses right into his mouth. Paul is in jail, too. He's serving 6 months at a federal prison in Lewisburg, not so far away from Mark. When he gets out, he will also have a job waiting for him, working for some guy who runs a business called the Missing Persons Bureau, which tracks missing people. There were a lot of people who wanted to hire Paul. The computer industry is not afraid of his felony conviction. The industry is filled with rebels, old-line hackers who understand how a brilliant kid could take a wrong turn and still be a brilliant kid. Don't worry about Paul. John was about to get out of jail, thinner, more muscular, in the best shape he'd ever been in his whole life. He thinks about college and asks friends to send him movie reviews. He can't wait to get back to his life in the film studies program he was enrolled in Brooklyn College. He's got lots of ideas for films he wants to make. Eli also has a job waiting for him when he gets out of Allenwood, the most famous of federal prisons. He'll program computers for a broadcasting company in Manhattan, working for a guy who has a computer science degree and who thinks Eli has a great amount of potential. They had all finally managed to learn how things work. They had all grown up and figured out how to fit themselves into a world that wasn't ready for their skills or their curiosity when they were younger. And Julio? He and Alan were the only ones who didn't get jail sentences. The government was so thankful that Julio offered to testify against Mark at trial that he escaped with a suspended sentence. He's been working for his uncle, who runs a dental lab, setting up computers. The LOD is just a memory, too. ComSec went out of business, and Chris Goggins is working for a large computer maker in Austin, Texas, researching advanced wireless networks. He's also assembled thousands of messages from various elite bulletin boards in the 1980s and sells the collection through a company called Lodcom. At the last HoHoCon, he was selling T-shirts, too. They said the Hacker War across the chest, and there was a map of the United States depicting Chris's version of major battle sites, mostly Houston and Austin and New York. On the back it said LOD-1, MOD-0, and there was a quote attributed to Corrupt that Chris said he got off ModNet. It's not just winning that counts, but making sure that everyone else loses. Would anyone from MOD ever again come to the hackers' meetings at Citicorp? Tonight a crowd is pecking and jabbing at the phones, right where John used to stand when he sweet-talked the operators. Nearby, a dark-jacketed youth sought advice from another wearing a Mets cap backward. You just go to the speakers and you move the phone jack. It's simple. Kids wearing beepers on their belts and cellular phones in their pockets greet one another. They pull printouts from their knapsacks to pass around. They cluster around a copy of the new 2600 magazine. The latest issue features stories about the MOD boys' plights, and on the cover is a ragdoll stabbed in the heart by a dagger. The shaft is labeled Berman. This is the next generation of hackers. MOD is the stuff of legends now, and the wide-open stretches of cyberspace that Mark and his friends had roamed have been fenced off by corporate owners. Still, the hackers flourish. Are any new conspiracies fomenting today? Well, there's the fuss about the Internet. Supposedly, some new group of hackers who call themselves the Posse have been breaking into the Internet, which has become by default the world's information superhighway. The number of Internet users is growing faster than the population of turn-of-the-century New York City. University networks, state networks, private networks, library networks. 20 million people use the Internet every day. And at the present rate of increase, the entire population of the world will be on the net by the year 2003. The net has virtually no security. It makes TimeNet look like a fortress. So it wasn't hard for the Posse to capture thousands of users' passwords before system administrators noticed the break-ins. Nobody knows what this new generation of hackers has in mind, but it sounds ominous. Plus, the modus operandi sounds familiar. So familiar that the FBI paid a visit to Allen recently. Of course, Allen wasn't charged with anything. Just an informational visit, you understand. Tonight, there's a bunch of kids crowded around one of the little cafe tables in the outdoor plaza, hunched over some inexplicable pile of wires rising like a crazy tornado from the tabletop, cords spilling over the edge, winding carelessly through the legs of a chair. The kids are intent on their work, whatever their work may be. One thing's noticeably different from 1989. Not all these kids are white. In fact, look around and you'll see that half of the new hackers hail from Jamaica, the island, not the Queens neighborhood, from the projects, from Colombia. They're first-generation settlers. They're the children of immigrants, the kids who moved into the neighborhoods where the MOD boys grew up. There's a nearly blind hacker. You can tell that his eyes don't focus because they aren't even the same size, aren't even open the same amount. He walks up to any dark shape he sees and issues a greeting. Are you new here? I don't remember you from last month. Maniac, a supremely wan ponytailed hacker from Brooklyn who wears thick black wraparound lenses for privacy, skulks the perimeter, swathed in a long coat. Razor, an ebullient 14-year-old whose social skills are remarkable in this group simply because they exist, flits from hacker to hacker, shaking hands, introducing himself, beaming a jowly grin. The twitching hacker, the nervous one who used to have a whole list of questions for Mark on topics like why the tone skipped a click when you dialed a 9, looks a little forlorn. So does Eric Corley, who carries with him the memory of dropping off Mark at the prison gates. Eric, who is thinner than ever, is dressed all in black. T-shirt and open-neck shirt and jeans. He looks older now and steadies his hand against his chin when he talks. He carries a scanner and invites people to hear a conversation in Russian. And into this fray, this wildly discombobulated massing of alienated adolescents, walks Barlow. It's a quiet entrance. Just a man in a black belted leather jacket and a throat scarf ambling into the center of the activity and stopping. Barlow stands there, hands in pockets, eyes all lit up at the wonder of this new experience. John Perry Barlow lives in New York City now, and he's the ambassador from the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Sometimes he goes on TV. Sometimes he writes articles. The foundation has become a power player in Washington, helping draft the blueprint for Vice President Al Gore's vision of cyberspace. Some people say the foundation has abandoned the little guy to embrace big ideas instead. Tonight, for the first time since he moved back east, for the first time since the December evening 4 years ago when he ran across two electronic explorers named Fiber Optic and Acid Freak, Barlow has come to a meeting. But somehow, Barlow arrived too late. His presence does not go unnoticed. Some of the hackers recognize him right away. Barlow, that's a trip, says Corley, and comes to greet him. Razor, who is about to launch his own commercial internet gateway, sees him too, and hustles over to shake hands. Hey, I met you once when you were with Bruce Sterling, says Razor, wedging himself in next to Corley. Unaware of what all the fuss is about, Maniac wanders up, gets introduced, half hears Barlow's name, wanders off. He doesn't know who he's met, not yet, and it will only be minutes before he realizes Barlow. The news whizzes around the atrium at the speed of thought, as Mark would have said.
Did I miss the meeting? Barlow asked Corley, watching the milling clumps of boys.
They are the picture of entropy, of disorganization, of isolated growing pains and undeveloped social skills.
No, this is the meeting.
Barlow's eyes sweep the indoor plaza, taking it all in. The Asian kid sitting cross-legged on the low wall, alone and reading 2600. The blind guy. The table covered with wires. Maniac sunglasses. Razor's grin. German tourists standing in line to use a payphone, puzzled by the wait. If he notices the absence of the most famous hackers, he does not comment on it. If he thinks about how he once offered to support them, he does not say so.
This is the meeting, Barlow says.
I get it. I get it. And he laughs, a huge, deep laugh. Of course this is the meeting.
This is the conspiracy.
The end. You've been listening to Masters of Deception, The Gang That Ruled Cyberspace, by Michelle Spatala and Joshua Quittner. Read and directed by Colby Elliott. Masters of Deception, The Gang That Ruled Cyberspace is also available in print by HarperCollins. Text copyrighted 1995 by Michelle Spatala and Joshua Quittner. Audio production copyright 2010 by Lastword Audio. All rights reserved. Except where permitted by the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, no part of this production may be reproduced or transmitted in any form or by any means or stored in a database or retrieval system without prior permission from the authors and Lastword Audio. If you've enjoyed this reading, please visit our website at lastwordaudio.com and thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.